Welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a SANID podcast, a podcast created primarily to celebrate African scientists and to talk about the awesome work that they do. This is our third episode we are recording. We are so excited for the journey we've been on. We thank every single one who has given us very good insights and thoughts and suggestions on how we can make ourselves better and how we can grow as SANID. So once again, a big welcome and a very warm welcome to those of you joining us for the first time. If this is your first time being here, don't forget to check out the first two episodes of SANID, and don't forget to leave us your thoughts and your insights as well. My name is Alex Nyako, and I'm hosting this podcast with
Selassie Rafekwache. And today, we are excited to have with us Dr. Yvonne Fondufe-Metzendorf to share her research with us and her research journey. So Yvonne, who is originally from Cameroon, is a professor at the University of Kentucky and is very interested in mentoring young scientists. And today she'll be telling us more about her research and some of the scientific mentoring that is very important to her. So thank you, Yvonne, for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm excited to be at this program.
Okay. So the very first question that we have for you is, can you share with us a snippet of your formative educational background and your connection with Africa?
So like you said, I'm originally from Cameroon. I did my early studies in Cameroon. Come from the 20% English speaking population of Cameroon. And at the time when I finished my A-levels, those of us from the English colonized area, it's A-levels, advanced levels. When I finished from there, there were no universities at the time catering for English-speaking population, 20% English-speaking population. So I went to Nigeria, where I did my first degree and my master's. And again, for young scientists who are very interested in probably coming out, I was one of the few or fortunate ones where we had a professor from Germany who came in to talk about their program, their PhD program at the University of Ibadan. And I heard about their program and I was very excited. And I thought, well, maybe I should apply to that. But again, like every other young African, you're scared that maybe in Germany, you're gonna learn German. What did I have to lose? I thought I was going to go there. I was going to study in German, whatever it took for me to study in German. And I went there. But the good thing there, which I think a lot of people don't get, is that you could actually do your PhD in English and it's free. And also, not only is it free, but you also have a tuition just like, you have the assistantship, TA assistantship. Teaching assistantship, which you can get, which would help you pay for your living allowances in Germany.
That's really
all
good.
Done in English, yeah. So I finished from there and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I moved from there to Max Planck, which was an institute next to the university in Germany where I did my PhD. I did a postdoc for 3 years. And then I moved to the US in Chicago. And there in Chicago, again, you have to be humble. This is what I've learned in the US. Not everything works the way you want it to work. You have to be willing to work extremely hard, but also open up to people and say, things are not working for me. Because the first lab I came to in Chicago, it didn't work for me, and I'd come in with a 2-month-old baby. Made my husband leave his job in Germany and came out with me. And so it was kind of difficult in the sense to make that decision to leave the lab.
But
I reached back to my former mentor in Germany and I said, this lab is not working for me. What can I do? And she said, well, I have a friend in Northwestern. You can go talk to him. And I looked at his webpage and I was like, oh my gosh, I know nothing in biophysics. I'm not so sure of myself. I don't know what I'm going to do. But desperate situations call for desperate moves, right?
Yeah.
I went there, gave a talk. And lo and behold, just by the time I went home, there was a phone call waiting for me that I could join the lab as a postdoc.
Nice.
That mentor, unfortunately, he passed just after I started doing my, after I got my position at UK, University of Kentucky. He was really like a father figure to me, scientific father to me, in the sense that never had I dreamt of getting a Nature paper. We know in science, if you get a Nature paper, it looks like you're out of this world, right?
Yes. So
it was not only one, it was not only two, it was not only three, you know. So for some reason, I started believing that I belong too, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
That was what he gave me. And I think I learned from him that hard work pays. Also, when things are not working, it's nice to talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, I thought I couldn't be a PI. I never dreamt coming from home that I would be a PI. Never thought I would be in this situation because I thought I wasn't sensible enough or I wasn't pushy enough. I'm coming from Africa. Yeah. They will not take me.
Seriously.
And I remember when I was about finishing and I was applying for jobs and he said, you're not going to apply to industry. I said, no, I want to go to industry because I'm going to make money. That's what I want to do. And he said, I'm not writing a letter of review or reference letter for you. And I was like, what? And he said, only if you're going to faculty. You know, on one situation, you're like, that means he believes in me, right? So someone believed in me. And for me, my passion now for students is I've gotten a lot of help. I've gotten a lot of, I believe, a lot of things I would not have gotten alone.
Yeah.
I push for younger Africans is that nothing is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You reach out to people, you reach out and say, I don't understand this. You reach out and say, what are the available courses? What are the available opportunities that are there? You too can belong. There's nothing, now looking back, yes, it's a lot of work being a professor, but I mean, I don't know whether it just became easier for me that I got it, but if not of the help from other people, I don't think I'll be here. So that's my hope and my what I can give back to the younger Africans who don't dare to believe.
Yeah.
That's deep. Thank you very much for sharing. I'm still thinking about all of that. It's really inspiring and really encouraging as well. So even wanted to talk about your research. So can you tell us a bit about your research and what you've been doing so far?
Okay, so I try to understand how your DNA in your cell, how your DNA is or controls gene expression. Gene expression means the proteins that are being made or the types of proteins that are made. And so I'm originally, I would always say I'm originally a chromatin biologist, which means that if we look at your cell, every eukaryotic cell, you have your DNA in the cell, but the DNA is not naked, right? What I mean naked is like you just don't see only DNA in there because you have chromosomes. So we have a nucleus, which is really, really, really tiny. But then you have a long DNA, which is about 2 meters long, that needs to be packaged into this tiny nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that DNA has to be wrapped and wrapped and wrapped and wrapped till it fits into that nucleus. So the question is, if every transcription factor or if every regulatory factor has to access that DNA, how does that DNA open up to allow those genes to be expressed? So what I study is epigenetics. And epigenetics means the information on top of the genetic information. And epigenetics means that how that DNA eventually opens up to allow for genes to be expressed, to allow for genes, if you have something that needs to be repaired, a part of that DNA that needs to be repaired, that DNA needs to open up to allow for that repair to take place.
Okay.
So epigenetics, I study epigenetics, how that is opened up, how that the DNA opens up. So if we look at your DNA in a eukaryotic cell, 147 base pair of DNA wraps around 8 histone proteins, or 146 base pair. Some people say 146 or 147. It wraps around 8 histone proteins. Depending on what modifications are present on those histone tails, it could open up that DNA, allowing for regulatory factors to access that DNA. Mm-hmm. If you imagine that your most compact form of your DNA is found as chromosome, that's really, really, really compact, okay? But that little portions need to be open at specific times and places. Yeah. Allow for genes to be expressed.
Yeah.
So you can imagine what I study right now is the whole concept of epigenetics came about when in the 1930s there was a famine in Holland. And so what they noticed was that the kids that were exposed to the famine when they were in the womb of their mom in utero, those kids learned to eat whatever was coming in. Those kids, when they were born, they became obese, and their kids and kids generations down that lineage, they also became obese. So their genes that have inherited that are staying open, allowing for those for high possibility to keep eating, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, their siblings who were already born and were exposed directly to the famine, they learned not to eat a lot. So the kids of those kids have stayed lean throughout.
Okay.
So again, they've had the same issues where you see twins, they have 99.9% of their genetic material the same.
Same.
One of them becomes obese because she's living in another area, and one of them stays lean. They have the same genetic material. So if you have the same genetic material, then you should be the same.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But you're not the same. A clear example that is very obvious to all of us is, if I commit a crime, the DNA that is found, it doesn't matter whether it's my blood or whether it's my saliva or whatever they take from me, that DNA is my DNA.
Yeah.
Yet I have my eyes, I have my hands, I have my legs. So you have the same genes present on your DNA, but whether they're expressed or not depends on the epigenetics in that cell. So what I study now is trying to understand, again, this is where we say where nature versus nurture, right? Where they end. In the sense that I live in a coal in Kentucky where mountains are being shaved, right? So arsenic is a heavy metal that is found in the soil. So when you shave the mountain during coal mining, the arsenic that is typically present in the soil then seeps into drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
So in most places, we would take our drinking water there, but it's been filtered. So we don't have the high levels of arsenic. In the places where coal is being mined or where rice is being farmed, you know, you're digging through the soil. So you're digging through the soil and exposing the arsenic. So these people are exposed to high levels of arsenic. It's actually been shown that there's high levels of cancer associated with that arsenic exposure, right? So the question for us is, arsenic is not a mutagen. So what do I mean it's not a mutagen? I always give this example. So let's say you're in a train station and you have a very long train that needs to come into the train station.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say your DNA is that long train. The driver or the conductor of that train needs to pack the train in such a way that if I'm standing, me as a passenger, and I need to enter coach A, I'll get it immediately into coach A. He doesn't have enough time to wander around, right?
Yeah. So
he'll pack in such a way that where he parks, passengers that need to enter coach A will get into coach A.
Mm-hmm.
There are times me also as a passenger, you could say I'm a regulatory factor. I need to know that I need to stand at the platform A to get in immediately. Mm-hmm. What if I need to get in and just get information? Let's say somebody had kept something for me in the seat on that one of those coaches. I'll need to go in and get in and get out immediately. So that's how regulatory factors are. You want to get in, get the information and go away. Your DNA is that long train. So there's so many regulations that are taking place. You as the regulatory factor, you have to be packed. You have to stand at a particular spot so you get in right immediately. You as the conductor, you need to park the train in such a way that people who are supposed to get in specific times and places get in. The difference with that and mutation is that for mutation, you have A, B, C, or coach A, B, C, D, E. For mutation, A, B, C is skipped and D is present. So that's the difference between epigenetics. Epigenetics is not the mutation on the DNA. It's actually how that DNA is packaged to allow me to read that information as well as the conductor or the passengers that have to come in. They have to go in at a particular time. So that's the difference. So arsenic is not a mutagen. It will not give you that mutations, A, B, skip C, and E. What it does is that it regulates or it dysregulates how that DNA is packaged, allowing maybe an oncogene to be expressed. So an oncogene are those genes that are expressed only during cancer. It allows those genes to be expressed. In some cases, you need to have we normally have a tumor suppressor gene, which suppresses the tumor, and those genes are always expressed. So when a mutation, when a something is causing cancer, what it does is that those genes that make it grow so wildly, those genes are heavily expressed. Those genes that would help it not grow wildly are suppressed, whereas are suppressed. So for normal cells, you'd have those genes that would make it grow wildly, they'll be suppressed. And those genes that will protect it so that it doesn't grow wildly, those genes will be expressed. The opposite is the case for cancer enhancing things that we have, right? So it's my way of thinking is what we eat, what we drink actually drives some of this process. It's like somebody would say, my father did not, we don't have cancer in our family.
In our family.
That's what they typically say in Africa. We don't have cancer in our family. You don't have cancer in your family, but you can develop that. And the good thing with epigenetics, or the unfortunate thing, whichever way you look at it, is that what I inherit is not the change in the gene. It's how that DNA is packaged. That gene is packaged. If I'm packaged in such a way that that gene now becomes opened up and things go in there, like for cancer, it might not even directly target me, but it might target my kids and generations down the
after,
line.
Yeah.
So this is, again, another way you could look at it. Right?
Wow, that's very interesting. That was a very interesting overview of your research. And I think it's very interesting how that plays a role on the final outcome, because it's very, it's true. A lot of people will say, this doesn't happen in my family. So why are you going through this? And so it's very important for us to know more about these things. So just going a little bit into you personally, just a little. So looking through your website, it's very obvious that you have a passion for science and fashion. And so do you think fashion can find its place in science? Because it's one of those things where a lot of people think scientists are just these like people that have unkempt hair, just looking through a microscope. So
I'm glad you say that, because I love fashion. and you can see my hair. So I laugh that I'm very atypical of a scientist, but that's good. So, right. Yeah. We don't have to be in the same boat. We could look differently. This is what I love. And what I tell my students is science is very stressful. If you're trying to be someone you're not, right? If you're trying to be someone that you're not, I don't think you have that time to actually sit down and think of what you need to do. I love fashion. When I'm very stressed, yes, I go shopping. I love looking at things. I wear the bright colors. That's just who I am. But it doesn't say I'm not intelligent to do this. And so I tell my students, don't let people make you be someone you're not, because the norm is that you have to, especially in the US, you wear jeans, you wear t-shirts, you know. I go in with my heels, I put it aside, and I go into the lab. That's who I am. I love that, right? Yeah. I feel good with myself. So the whole thing is feeling good about who you are, so that when you encounter the problems, you're not looking at it and saying, oh, someone is watching me. Someone is, this is not what I feel. I don't feel good here.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
so much stress. This, you shouldn't add this to how stressed you're going to be. So I tell them, be yourself. If you love fashion, do whatever you want to do and just bring this in.
That's
very different.
Very different. Yeah. I'm very different. Maybe that's also the issue, right? So, but I'm very different. So,
but I really like the point about encouraging students to be themselves and not necessarily conform to what is being placed on them, so that they can have the avenue of thinking and being creative.
Yeah.
So going back to the whole point about directing students, wanted to find out, what do you really love most about mentoring students? So we noticed that you have a lot of students that you mentor in your lab, from high school right through to postdoctoral students. What do you love about doing this, and why do you do this so much in addition to your research and teaching activities?
So I'll start by why I love doing this. I remember being I had my master's from Nigeria. And I was going to Germany for my PhD. And well, if you have a master's in Africa, you've not seen some of the things they have here, right? So I claimed in Africa, I'd already done molecular biology. And I walked into a lab in Germany and I looked at everything I'd never seen before, right? So I started, and Germany, your PhD is 3 years. So you have to be done.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, I'm like, what is this? I don't know any of this. Make a gel. I'm like, what? You know, I've never done a gel before. You know, so I had this postdoc in Germany. Mm-hmm. I followed her everywhere she went. I mean, then they didn't even have the cell phones, but I was writing everything she was doing. Wow. I mean, I give her credit. And that's why I'm saying that a lot of people, we might think, okay, we're Blacks, we're from Africa, people might not know. People are really willing to help you if you just tell them that, I don't know. So I was willing to say, I have no idea. Yes, I have. Because you're coming with a master's degree, how can you come with a master's degree and you've never seen this? I've never seen it. Yeah. I have to be honest, I've never seen it. Yeah. Yes, you've read a lot about in textbooks, you've read about all the protocols. You know everything, but I've never seen it. So I had to start all over, following her, making this buffers from one buffer to the next, running the gels. And I still had to get data to be able to graduate. So she helped a lot. I mean, I'll be there in the lab late at night, just because there are times I even took my pipettes home just to make sure that I knew how to work with the pipettes. These are microliters. We're done with mills. Right. Yeah. So it's so hard for you to explain to everybody that I'm coming already handicapped than a lot of you who are already working there. Right. So, but she was very willing. She helped me. So I look at that and say, she went all out to help me. My mentor of my postdoc went all out to help me. He didn't have to. I never thought someone would believe in me that I could do it, right? Just because I'm struggling, I'm working hard, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And so that passion for me to give back. And I think for Africans, it's not that we're not smart. The opportunity is just not there for us. We don't have that opportunity. So I go all out. I try to bring high school students, you know, and you could see them. They come in, like when I came in for my master's, but they are high school students. They come in and they look at everything. They're like, they have no idea what they're going to do, right? Yeah. But they stay with me during the summer for 3 months. Unfortunately, I had this National Science Foundation grant that says I should bring in high school students or undergrads. So I tried to bring them in and I pay them in the summer to work in the lab. And you could see them first day, they have no idea. They're all like this naive look and, you know, just so scared. That's how I was the first day I went into the lab, right? Yeah. But give them 3 months, after 3 months when they finish. I mean, they're talking to you like scientists.
Yeah.
You see the joy in them. I mean, in fact, one of them just left my lab today. Today was her last day. I mean, she brought chocolate and she was just like, I just want to thank you because it's changed my life. She, in her mind, she said, I was going to do MD. I was going to do medicine. Now doing science, I can see how I can ask questions and not being scared of asking those questions. Yeah. And the fact that I let them, even when they fail, it's okay. Because I say, I failed. I mean, I remember the first thing they gave me when I came in is to make EDTA. And I mean, EDTA, you have to have the pH. You have to change the pH before the thing will dissolve. I made the first buffer. I put it there. It's stirring and stirring. Nothing. It didn't dissolve. I dumped it away. I did the second one. I left it overnight. Gee. And after 3 days, I asked, I said, this thing is not dissolving. Is it wrong salt? Or no, you have to put the pH, you know. So, of course, I will never make that mistake again. So what I tell them is that it's okay to make that mistake because you'll never make it again.
Yeah.
But you learn. Yeah. And I think for maybe a lot of us coming from Africa, which is what for me at first was being scared to say, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
The longer you say, I don't know, you stay longer in this program.
Yeah.
If you say, I don't know, and I'm willing to learn, do whatever. I'll work late hours, I'll long hours, I'll do that. It helps you. A lot of things become faster.
Yeah.
So the joy for me is seeing these kids come in just like me, not knowing anything. And then eventually after 3 months, because they have to defend what they've done, you hear them talking and you're like, did they just say that? You know, you really feel good because they're now really bold. But you know, for them, they have this opportunity coming in as high school students.
Yeah.
A lot of us from Africa don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
So for me, if I can, I know visas are issues and stuff like that, but if the students can come in and learn, and all I just tell them, my African brothers and sisters, is, if you're coming here, just work. No, you're coming here to work extremely hard because you're already a little deficient because you don't have that. And you should be willing to accept that you don't have it, but just work a lot, which is what I did my first 2 years, you know, and people will be willing to help you. So you don't know, people will be willing to help you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very true. And I think back to some of the experiences, and I think one of the main ones for me was with PCR. Like back home, PCR I was lucky. I got to work in a research facility and very early, so I saw PCR at least right after my undergraduate level. Mm-hmm. But by the time I came here, like undergrads are working using the PCR so it's just very interesting to see that difference.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of us don't have, we know everything in the textbook, right? Really bringing it back here, you know, reality looks very different. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work, and why doesn't it work, right? So
Well, that was really helpful. And it's true. Once you say you don't know, that's going to help you to be able to make it more. And so our last question for you is, what are your thoughts about women in STEM in Africa? And how do you think we can encourage further participation of women in STEM fields?
So that's good. I think one way I think that could be helpful is first, our husbands or our brothers. Because I remember when I said I wanted to do a PhD, I mean, everybody said, oh, who's going to get married to you? I had a father, my father passed away, and I still give him every credit for where I am today. Because we're 9 of us, there's 6 boys and 3 girls. And all the 3 girls have PhDs. And what he said is that you don't have to marry if the guy doesn't accept what you want to do in life. So I'll give an example also. My husband is German. He doesn't have a he has a master's, but no PhD. He was willing to, you know, it's what they say that both of you cannot be competing.
Yeah.
The same way to get to the same position.
Mm-hmm.
Just because somebody needs to stay home, we started having kids and somebody needs to come back.
Yeah.
I'm kind of begging our African brothers that they should be willing, if the wife is the one that is so driven, it's for your benefit, it's for your family's benefit. If the wife is so driven, one person steps back. He stepped back. You know, when we came here, he didn't have, I was the only one that had a work permit.
Mm-hmm.
So he stayed home with the two-month-old baby. Till she was one, I barely knew what I was doing with her. So he was the stay-home dad. But you see, the thing is that I kind of have a feeling that it might not have happened with an African guy just because the family would start pushing. What are you doing? How can you stay home? You'd hear all these things. How can you stay home? Why are you stay at home? Why is she the one working? So that gives a lot of my sisters a drawback because they're like, I cannot do this if I'm going to have a family.
Yeah.
Going into science is a lot of it's a lot of time. Yeah. It's a lot. I stay long hours, right?
Yeah.
Even now, when I became an assistant professor, I would not have gone through to the full professor if I didn't have someone who's home with the kids because I fly out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I calculated 2 years ago, I was out 80 days a year giving talks, right?
Wow.
We have to have that support. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with a woman being more educated than the spouse. Nothing wrong with it. We're all different paths. So long as we each respect each other, respect each other's work.
Yeah.
I think if our sisters could hear that from our brothers,
mm-hmm.
a lot of us need to be in this field. And I don't see us being in that field.
Because
there's a drawback of the family. No one is going to marry you. You can't have kids. You can't do this. You're more educated than your husband. It's not more educated. It's just a different level of education.
Yeah.
Right. So if we could have that, it would change a lot of young girls to also come to this path. And it's another thing I should say also is, You would know that, right? Because we know as postdocs or as PhDs, we don't make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right. In science, we don't make a lot of money. So if an African family is looking at that and say, oh, they're going to make a lot of money, we don't make that much money. Yes, we stay long in school. The only time you start making that money is after you become the professorship, then you become, but it's a lot of years, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we need to hone on to our sisters and brothers that fast money you're thinking you're going to get, you'll not get it. But look at the long run. As a professor, you can actually be working till you're 90. Right? So with those fast money, you're going to, within a short space of time, you cannot work that much anymore. So if you're looking for an impactful life, you're having it as a professor because you can work till so late.
Yeah.
But then your work is recognized. People know that you will not make that money fast, but it will be long.
Mm.
So if you look at it at the end, you're probably even making more than people who started making, like my friends, all of them. I mean, when we finished first degree, a lot of them went to work. I mean, I was sitting there as a PhD student with what? Nothing, right? Just nothing. You don't have much money. As a postdoc, also nothing. But if I look at it and the stress they've been in life, whether they change jobs left and right, you know, the stability, I think, after you become a professor is there. Yes, you fight for grants, you fight for things. But I always say to myself, if a lot of Africans, what we went through back home, whatever we're stressed with here, you're not here with your family, you're not here with anything. So any other stress is a minor stress.
Yeah.
You know, you did come here for a purpose. And that's all that purpose you're looking for. Nothing else.
Right.
So we can, if we put aside all of this, I know a lot of friends quit being friends with me because I just didn't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them who understood what I was going through stayed as friends. Yeah. Those who didn't stay as friends, that's life. I couldn't change it because I came here for a purpose. Mm-hmm. I worked long hours. They did not work long hours and they couldn't understand why I'm not going to parties with them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we need to stress to them that I would love in whatever way possible to help my young sisters and brothers back home who think they want to come into science. Because there's a lot there. And I always say, we always feel, well, I can't compete with the people here. Why can't you? We just can't compete because we are not exposed. It doesn't mean we are not intelligent enough. We're just not exposed.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the governments in Africa, we cannot probably bring real good institutes back home for them to be exposed. So whatever opportunity they have, if they feel like reaching out to me, right, I could help them in whatever situation, I could help direct them where I can, that would be good also. So my hope is that more of us should be in the field. Yeah. We should be at the table also talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not letting people tell us what we need to do.
Okay.
We can also participate in that.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a powerful ending.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I think for me what really stands out is and reinforcing that we also belong. We have a seat at the table as well. Yeah. We need to claim that seat.
Yeah.
To make the changes that we want to see as well.
I mean, I look at it like I see the Chinese and the Indians. They come in and they bring their people along. Even when they don't know how to, their English is not good. They work. Yeah. They know why they've come. We should also have that we're coming here to make a life better. Maybe our lives or generations down the line, their lives better. But we belong at that table. We are also smart enough. You hear all those things where they say the black man is not smart.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. We're just not exposed.
Yeah.
We're just not exposed. If we're exposed and we take our seat at that table, we'll also make a difference.
Thank you.
Lightning words, really. Glad that you've joined us for our third episode. It's been wonderful speaking to you and tapping into your wonderful insights and thoughts. Very excited that you've been with us. And I believe that all our listeners, all our viewers have also gained the wealth of knowledge and wisdom that you've shared with us. And we are glad that you joined us tonight. So thank you, Dr. Mittendorf, for joining us. And thank you, all our listeners, all our viewers, for joining us on our third episode of SANI.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. So as usual, you can find us on Facebook as SANI, Instagram as at SANI Podcast, and YouTube as SANI Podcast. So don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. And for our viewers on Facebook and Instagram, as well as YouTube, send us your comments on today's episode. We want to hear from you. We want to know what you think about our episodes and any thoughts that you have about what you want to see in the future. And so just let us know what you think, and we will see you at our next session.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.